Welcome to the Wall Street News Network podcast, where my guest today is historian and investor, Dr. Joseph S. Moore, author of the book, How to Get Rich in American History, 300 Years of Financial Advice That Worked and Didn't. He is a professor whose self-experimentation with history's wildest financial strategies made him financially independent in his mid-40s. Welcome, Dr. Moore.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Fred. Enjoyed and looking forward to being here.
Oh, great. Why don't we start a little bit about your background? I understand you basically came from poor families, and that will give everybody a kind of a perspective of how you finally ended up versus where you started.
So I come from the working class South. And, you know, as I like to say, like, I come from where the money is not. We didn't talk about money because there wasn't enough to furnish a topic of conversation, as Mark Twain said. So my mother, to give an example, was the sixth child born into a house with no flush toilet. Wow. And my grandfather planted one extra field of peas one year to afford to install a flush toilet himself. So when you come from a family that remembers getting its first flush toilet, you think of capitalism and life in capitalism for everyday people in a little bit of a different way. And it certainly has been, it's certainly not what everyone's normal journey is.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what was a turning point in your life that made you change from, you know, just getting by to finally getting ahead?
Yeah, so I, you know, because I didn't worry much about money because money wasn't a thing I could see from where I was, I loved history, and I learned early on that I could kind of parlay that into a career in academia. So I was getting my PhD in history when in 2005, everyone said the thing to do was to buy a house because renting was throwing your money away. And I mm-hmm. nodded my head like everybody else and took that advice. And in 2008, a friend led a personal finance class at church. We took it. And to make a very long story very short, I realized, who in the world gave us a mortgage? Like, we have no business owning a house.
Wow.
So my wife and I sold our house in 2008, put it on the market. It sold on a Saturday. And the following Saturday, our neighbor put her house on the market and it never sold. So we were the last two people off the financial Titanic, my wife and I.
Gee.
And what that led us to understand was that, what it led me wondering was, how do I know so much history? Now, I've read books, I'm getting a PhD, but I knew nothing that would have actually helped me survive the wild times of the boom and the 2008 crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went on a quest to understand, what have Americans been told to do with their money for 300 years? And did it work? How has it changed? Mm-hmm. Is there one kind of timeless wisdom that always stood the test of time, or was what worked, what always worked, always changing? Mm-hmm. And so that became, after 10 years of research, the book today.
Okay. Now, you didn't just do research. You didn't research history only. You actually tried some of its worst financial ideas for yourself. So why don't you tell us about two or three of the most outrageous examples?
Well, Americans have done a lot of different things to try to get ahead, and some of it's smart and much of it isn't. So I'll give you some fun examples. In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, as people began to think about space and how humanity would cross into that frontier, there, of course, became the question of ownership. And to this day, there are groups that claim they own terrestrial space. And so I bought 1 acre of land on the moon by the Sea of Serenity, which was advertised to me as having phenomenal earth views and zoned for tourism, which I thought, well, that makes sense, because if it was zoned for heavy industrial, that would ruin the phenomenal earth views.
Gee.
Of course, I purchased that not to make money, although it does make for a great cocktail story.
Mm-hmm.
But I purchased that to kind of illustrate that in American history, real estate investments really usually only made money when you improved the real estate. And of course, I can't do anything to improve my acre of land on the moon. So we see all these moments in time where Americans rush into an investment because they believe in this case that it will literally go to the moon, but they haven't really thought through the implications of it. I'll give you another example. One thing that people hear often is that you can beat the market. Beat the market.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the studies say that you can beat the market. There are plenty of studies that show people beating the market. If you couldn't beat the market, there would be no Warren Buffett.
That's true.
But the question is beating the market worth it for the average investor? And as I explain in the book, I shorted every stock Jim Cramer said to buy under a very strict set of criteria,
mm-hmm.
because there's an economics paper called the Cramer Balance that specifies that under a very strict set of criteria, when Jim Cramer recommends buying a stock, that stock is likely to pop and then recede back to the mean within about 55 days.
Hmm.
Now, I actually did that for 3 months of my life, glued to the television, and beat the market technically. Well, here's the problem with that. While I spent weeks and weeks and weeks of my life trying to wait for all of these things to come together, and while Jim Cramer was screaming at me like I was a child, my wife hollered, "Come quick, she's doing it." And I missed my daughter's first steps because I was trying to beat the market. Now, I beat the market. Was it worth it? If you do what the professionals do and you beat the market by about 0.5% a year, which they really do beat the market by about 0.5%,
mm-hmm.
they've got $600 million. That means they're likely to beat the market by quite a good amount.
Mm-hmm.
But if you beat the market with your median 401k balance, you're going to get an extra $500. It's not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the kind of experiments that I would go on to try to understand what had Americans done? Does it work? Can you beat the market? And is beating the market what you should be spending your time on?
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, cryptocurrency has been in the news in the past. For some reason lately, other things have been in the financial news. But why don't we talk a little bit about cryptocurrency? What did you learn from that?
Yeah, so I founded my own cryptocurrency as one of the many experiments that I did for this book. And I'll tell you that I think the future of crypto is real. I think cryptocurrency as a technology is likely to have a long-lasting impact.
Mm-hmm.
But Bitcoin is not likely to be that long-lasting impact, despite the fact I said recently that Bitcoin is to the future of money as Zeppelins are to the future of air travel, meaning it was a technology, believe it or not, that came before the Wright brothers flew in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the first commercial airline in America, first commercial airline in the world was a Zeppelin-based airline. And people dreamed that in the future, everyone would fly around the world in Zeppelins. Well, we don't fly around the world in Zeppelins because the Zeppelin pointed the way to being a technology of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It showed people you could believe in a world where you could fly, but it wasn't the best technology for a world where you could fly. And similarly, Bitcoin is not the best technology for a world with on-chain 24/7 financial currency exchanges. So I do worry that we've seen many lessons in history, and one of which is probably pointing to Bitcoin not being the future of money that people think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Better historical analogy is euro dollars. So if you go to euro dollars in the 1950s and 60s, people were starting to realize that the world had a hunger to trade in U.S. dollars, but they didn't have access to the U.S. financial systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so U.S. banks basically put dollar liabilities on their books and said, you can trade against these. Well, that's exactly what's happening right now with dollar-backed stable coins.
Uh-huh.
So stable coins are showing themselves to be a very useful path to the future for crypto, but Bitcoin is ill-suited to that purpose. So I worry for investors that they are buying a narrative of the future that isn't the actual future.
I see. Do you want to discuss your billionaire situation with crypto? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, one of the things we hear a lot about, especially right now with Elon Musk becoming the first trillionaire, mm-hmm. is net worth, right? That,
mm-hmm.
that should people be allowed to have this kind of a net worth? And historically, the idea of net worth is somewhat odd. George Washington could not have told you what his net worth was.
Mm-hmm.
So to illustrate that, I made my own cryptocurrency, and then through a series of trades in the market, I used one wallet to trade against another wallet, and I swapped what I call billionaire-ly, my billionaire-ly token, for some U.S. dollar-backed coins. And for about a week, the exchange registered my wallet, which had 1.1 billion Airly tokens, as worth $1.1 billion because I'd traded a dollar for a token.
Wow.
Well, what does that mean? It means, well, I'm glad I don't live in California, because had I made myself a billionaire in California, I might have owed a really big tax bill based on what's coming. But it's entirely fictional. I made it up, right? There's no wealth there. There's just tokens valued at a certain value according to an exchange. And I think we misunderstand net worth, because the debts you take out against your net worth remain, even if the equity value goes away. And I think we're seeing right now the kind of puffing up of equity values to create conversations around net worth that aren't that real.
Mm-hmm.
And I did. So that experiment was a chance to make myself a billionaire, whether or not it mattered.
Yeah. Well, that's a great story. One of your chapters in the book, you talk about fast time and slow time. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. So I have a sense as a historian that most people who think about markets casually have a sense of history that is wrong. We have all the popular histories of markets are what I call fast time histories, when everything is changing everywhere all at once. It's always 2008. It's always 1929. And all the smart people saw it coming, and your goal is to not be one of the people who gets left holding the bag.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem with that is that's not how most of financial history is lived. Those books are not written. Those movies are not made to teach you what to do with your money. They are murder mysteries in which you are supposed to yell at the screen, you know, he's behind you. The subprime mortgage lender is behind you. Run away. But that's not how to live your financial life.
Mm-hmm.
They're great for entertainment. So the reality is most of your financial life is lived in slow time. And slow time can be very loud. I'm about to publish an essay on my Substack about this, that in which I point out some New York Times headlines from 1 year, and within 3 months, one headline says that a depression is about to happen, and the next one says an economic boom is likely to go on and last. These headlines are in a random year, like 1952, where nothing really financially happened in the markets. So slow time can be very loud, but it doesn't mean that just because people are screaming at you doesn't mean anything is really happening. So most of your financial time is going to be lived in slow time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the decisions you make in slow time that will really matter for your long-term financial health.
I see. Okay. So based on all your research and your knowledge, what do you think people should be doing now with their money?
What a great question. I think right now, I mean, of course, obviously so much of that is individualized to where people are and where they sit in, you know, in relation to how much money they're making, et cetera. But I would boil it getting ahead today down to a few kind of key principles. Number one is, can you solve somebody else's problem? Because most financial advice that you read is geared on you and your problems. You know, should you drink lattes? Should you buy crypto? Well, those are conversations about you and your problems. But a study of history shows the real money is made solving someone else's problem.
Mm-hmm.
And when you solve somebody else's problem, that's where the biggest rewards are. So the second thing you should do is be less risk averse. Americans have never lived in a less risky age. Your house, your spouse can all be insured, and yet we are more risk averse than we've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
There's incredible opportunity in this market, especially for, you know, people willing to take career risk. And here, I'm not talking about investment risk, like borrowing money against your 401k to buy Bitcoin. That's gambling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm talking about things where you have some measure of control over the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
The next thing I would do is move more, especially if you're young. The rewards to moving are not only transformational, they're generational. People who move for an economic opportunity make more money in their lifetime, and their kids make more money in their lifetimes.
Really?
Yes.
I hadn't heard that.
So, yeah, and Americans used to move all the time. One in three Americans changed addresses every single year in the 1800s. By 1950, it was still one in five. Today it's 1 in 13, and a whole lot of those people are people retiring to Arizona. So young people willing to get up and move where the opportunity is have an incredible chance at outsized returns.
Wow.
The last thing I would say, the last two things, is marry well. Marriage has mattered in every financial era, no matter what. It survives the test of time as a financial strategy. And finally, believe you can. Optimism is wildly over-rewarded in the American economy. And far too many people today have bought into an economic doom and gloom pessimism that isn't rewarding them or anyone else. Well, it is rewarding somebody else, mostly the people telling you to not believe you can get ahead.
Yeah. All right. Okay. We're down to the last question. Any last piece of advice to our listeners, no matter what their age is, or maybe you can tailor it to young versus middle to senior citizens?
Yeah. I would say, I'm going to kind of piggyback on what I just mentioned about optimism versus pessimism.
Mm-hmm.
There is what I call a despair industrial complex. And that there are no clicks for journalists. There are no votes for politicians. There is no tenure for academics like me telling you that the world is getting better. But they can get all of those things telling you the world is getting worse, that you should be scared. The reality is you have never lived in a more prosperous nation, and humanity has never lived in a more prosperous time. So believing that you can get ahead is the first step in actually getting ahead. And I would encourage people to understand that all the constant pessimistic messaging that they're receiving is there for someone else's benefit, not theirs. But historically, Americans have never been wealthier. Getting ahead has never been easier statistically. And you have a better chance of getting ahead and living a great life today than ever before. I promise you, if I took you to any when in history, you would rather be your age today than at any point before.
That's a good point. Well, you've given a lot of good information. I really appreciate it. And I want to repeat the name of the book again, How to Get Rich in American History, 300 Years of Financial Advice That Worked and Didn't, by Dr. Joseph S. Moore. Thanks again, Dr. Moore, for your information.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation, Fred. Thanks so much.